I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. And in addition, he teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. Writing most recently at the Las Vegas Journal about the Biden administration, the early days of the Biden administration. 100 days have not passed, and yet there are large presentations by Mr. Biden that suggest that he has a theme. The theme is bigger than FDR, bigger than LBJ, bigger than FDR and LBJ together. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration, but trillions and trillions and trillions. Richard, a very good evening to you. Mr. Biden, his campaign and his inaugural speech talked about bringing us together. That's an old phrase from the 20th century. He also talked about the era of good feelings, which you quote in your Las Vegas Review Journal piece. Mr. Biden would have a tough task given the enmity in this country after the most recent election. However, the puzzle is, what's he doing about it? And right now, as I understand, it satisfies the Biden administration to claim bipartisanship is a fact if a Republican anywhere on the planet backed a program they're advancing at any time in the last 100 years. Good evening to you, Richard.
Well, I mean, there was an era of bipartisanship. For example, if you go back to the Cold War policies in the post-war era, 1945, 1955, saw Democrats and Republicans embracing a cautious internationalism, which led to the foundation of NATO and the UN at the time. Both sensible moves led to a collective action with respect to Korea, led to the Berlin Airlift and so forth. But this current situation, there's absolutely no overlap between the parties. And you think about the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which I referenced at that point, you had 29 Republican votes or 27 Republican votes joining with 44 Democratic votes to beat cloture. And it was clearly a bipartisan effort, and there was some compromise along the way. But Biden's definition of a compromise is, I'm going to do something, and if you don't agree with me, I'm going to call you a name. And so what's going to happen is he's going to find that the Republicans will be unified against him because of the contemptuous way in which he treats them. And the Democratic Party is not a big enough tent in order to keep their rest of progressives in line with their more moderate members. So there's a deep situation there. If you recall, there had been a discussion inside the party about whether or not they used the word socialist in the way in which AOC had used it. And many of the moderate Democrats recoiled at that because they realized that they would then be put out on the fringe and they would basically lose their seats. So I think, in effect, what's happened with the current bills that they're putting forward, it's an odd bill. It's got so much in there. Progressives want more. The moderates probably want less. What they're doing is they're bundling everything together. So you have to take their proposal with respect to home health care on the one hand in order to do the stuff on infrastructure. And the advice that I gave them in that particular column is, by all means, unbundle everything that you can and put them forward as separate proposals. See which ones float and see which ones do not. But if you tie them together, I think at this point you're going to lose everything rather than win everything.
Let us speak to the infrastructure bill. It might be two, it might be $3 trillion. I've lost count. But in any event, the infrastructure bill coming on top of the so-called stimulus bill, the $1.9 trillion, is flooding money or promise of money into an economy that is doing very well, Richard. And the puzzle here is that annoying to the Biden administration that the recovery is underway without them? Are they trying to get out front and take credit for distributing cash?
Yes, look, the problem that they have is that Trump may have been a very unattractive candidate personally with his excesses and so forth, but most of the policies that he put into place were pretty good. The Biden administration tried to short shrift him with respect to the development of the vaccine, but everybody knew that that was a ruse. The distribution is the key issue now, and that's not something that is going to be done by the president. It's going to be something by the drug companies on the one hand or by the states for better or for worse on the other. So he's got nothing to show for this. The recent jobs report was very favorable to a new creation, and you can't attribute it to Biden legislation, which hasn't happened. Stock market is starting to move up. And so what he's trying to do is to claim credit for some of this stuff by putting two bulls forward, the most likely consequence of which would be to dampen the improvement that's otherwise taking place. The Democrats simply cannot let themselves believe that higher taxes produce some negative consequences. And so long as you live in that kind of a dream world, then you're always going to tax somebody in some particular way. You'll do it in Washington, then you'll do it in New York, as Cuomo is trying to do, and you won't even think about the fact that the two additive taxes together are going to be more dangerous than simply their sum. There's going to be a synergistic effect between them.
Not only is the White House proposing higher taxes for corporations, and meaning for all of us, because that'll be passed on, either that or they'll cut jobs numbers, but the Secretary of the Treasury, former Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, is now recommending a global corporation tax. And it's explained to me, Richard, I'm insufficiently cynical, that the reason the Secretary is going forward with that is that she knows she'll meet favorable opinion in Europe, and at the same time, she and others, the secretary and others, are seeking to, in some way, get out front of corporations who can vote with their feet. When you raise corporate taxes, they can go elsewhere. Yeah. And a global tax would make that impossible. But, Richard, that seems unclever of Janet Yellen.
Well, I mean, it's clever, but it's unwise. I mean, there's the famous Milton Friedman joke, which I always like to tell, which is, he says, well, you've got an imperfection. There's a hole in the front of the boat. And so what do you do in order to make sure that the boat is level? You put a hole in the back of the boat. What you do, in effect, is you try to counter one imperfection by creating another. The two things aggregate. When you see that there's a problem, what you do is you fix it rather than trying to create some kind of weird offset. And cutting the taxes down to the 21% seems to have had the desired effect. Everybody understands that if you give a tax break or a lower level of tax to investment, it's going to increase investment, which in turn will translate into increasing wages as the bidding up of employees will start to take place. All of these things are sort of well known, but essentially what the Biden administration, even Ms. Yellen, who should know better than that, seems to think is that anything you do, you can compartmentalize so that the only consequences that will happen are those which you want to happen. All of the collateral effects, the unintended consequences in terms of the reduction of output and the reduction in wages and the reduction in employment is something, since we don't will it, it can't happen at all. And watching the Democrats do this stuff is like watching a kind of a death dance take place in front of you. And the Republicans will be united against it. And there's just enough gap, as I mentioned before, inside the Democratic Party that they won't be able to sustain the majorities. Look, let's go back again. If you go back to what people thought last July 1st, they thought that the Democrats would increase their seats in the House and would surely take control of the Senate by either 52 or 53 votes. Well, none of those things happened. So why you take a situation in which you lost ground everywhere but the presidential election and treat it as a mandate and hope that everybody will forget what they voted a couple of months ago is just very unwise. And as far as I can tell, Joe Biden seems to be catatonic at this particular point. You look at him, it's not at all clear what he knows what's going on or what he wants to do. So he's living on instinct and memory on the one hand and a set of dubious advisors whom we don't even know are influential on the other. And people like Yellen, who have always had a left-wing tendency, are basically moving even further because there's no sensible person in the White House who can restrain what she does.
You report in your column in the Las Vegas paper that supermajorities are best for large changes in American governance. Mm-hmm. We're well short of supermajorities. However, is that opinion still shared by both parties, or is this going to be I win, you lose for the rest of our time in the 21st century?
Well, it was said for a very, very long time. So, for example, you know, there's some things like treaties. You need a two-thirds majority. It also turns out that in many particular cases, you want to make a constitutional amendment. A simple majority is not going to do it. You may not have supermajorities when majority votes in either of the two houses and can get something through, but you do have the Senate filibuster on the one hand, and trying to get majorities in both houses is a lot harder than trying to get it in only one. And the basic instinct about this is that these are long-term structural changes. You want to have some confidence that you're going in the right direction. If it turns out that you can do it by a very small vote, two things happen. One is you're not confident because you don't have enough of a majority to do it. And secondly, turnabout is fair play, so the other guys can start to reverse it. And the great tension you have is between the time horizons of politicians on the one hand and of business folks on the other. Investments, particularly in this highly regulatory society, can often take a decade to materialize. At that point in time, you're going to have two or three changes in legal regimes that govern it, and nobody can make long-term investments when it turns out that the legal infrastructure is basically unstable. And supermajorities help prevent that from happening. So I'm very much in favor of those kinds of things when it comes to structural reforms. I think it's very different when you start talking about appointments to various places. You don't want the judges to be kept empty. They got to get more. And so the same thing with officials. So I would think their majority rule is correct with the following distinction. If you're talking about people being appointed to the administration, I think as a dissenting party member, you should give pretty much deference to the president for doing it, unless you get somebody who really puts your nose out of joint. And I think the Republicans have basically gone along with basically all of these appointments except the budget director woman, and she was opposed by many Democrats. When you're talking about judges, it's kind of an intermediate case because they serve for more than 4 years, but you can't leave the benches empty. So generally speaking, I think you're entitled to give it a harder look, but I think it would be very dangerous to play the complete obstructionist game by denying people a hearing through procedural maneuvers, for example. And so what's happened is when you get this kind of polarization, if there's a filibuster, nothing gets done. And it turns out if there's the slightest deviation, one Democrat breaks off, it turns out that you can't even get your judges through. The Democrats have been very slow. I think they finally put forward a list of 10 names. This is now in the third month of the presidency. And by this time, Donald Trump is roaring along because he had a majority. What's the problem that the Democrats have? Is they know if they go too far to the left, they're going to basically unify the Republicans, and they'll probably pick up one or two Democratic votes. Right? And if they go too far to the right, the progressives will basically stop it. What you try to do is to give a balanced slate. The problem with balanced slates is it doesn't say that because you put half and half, 50% of both groups are going to get through. So the guys that you don't want may be the ones who get through. The guys that you do want won't get through. And so there's a deep kind of suspicion taking place because even though you can control the slate, you can't control the vote. So the Democrats basically are fine in a difficult position. World would have been completely different. There would have been a total stand down if either of the two seats in Georgia had gone the other way, because at that particular point, nothing would get through the Senate unless Biden indicated a greater willingness to compromise than he's shown thus far.
You mentioned Georgia, so I'd like to turn to the contretemps over Georgia's voting laws passed by the legislature and the decision of Major League Baseball to leave Georgia for the All-Star game and go to Colorado, because the laws in Colorado and the laws in Georgia compare. They compare not unfavorably. It's a puzzle. Richard Epstein, Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network.